Hello, hello.
Ooh, wait.
What? Ah, that means an evening recording.
Evening recording.
I actually I'm finishing off a growler here. It doesn't make a nice sound.
Glug, glug, glug.
glug. Exactly. When you hear me knock it off the table and it crashes and breaks a little while, that'll be the sound we get. So, this coming Monday is World Thinking Day.
Finally, a day off.
What, a day off from what? From everyone else not thinking? It is World Thinking Day, but in an exercise in dichotomy, it is also International Margarita Day.
I think one leads to the other. Margaritas leads to actually not thinking day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That is, they're juxtaposed, I think.
They are. Mutually exclusive is how I would term them normally. I was presented with this conundrum the other day by someone, and I said, I think you got to pick one or the other. You can't really celebrate both.
I don't know where to go with that, but okay.
Yeah, I don't know either. I think the moment you decide to indulge in International Margarita Day, you've, by definition, absolved yourself of World Thinking Day.
I think we should go back and answer a bunch of questions that we've never gotten around to, mostly because I've forgotten about them.
Sure, we can do that.
I mean, because squirrel, I have that problem.
And I was going to call the episode Mailbag, but I much prefer calling it Answering Questions That We'd Forgotten About Because James Never Got Around to Them. I think that's a much better title for this episode.
Hey, it's the truth.
Yes.
Sometimes the truth hurts.
It can. All right. Well, I've got a whole bunch of questions here from our faithful listeners.
Okie dokie.
And as per usual, I can't pronounce some of the words, and they're underlined in red in my spell checker because I don't think they're real.
Uh-oh.
Mm-hmm. I have to clear my throat in order to say some. Hold on. These are a little tricky.
Was it in German? And Klingon?
And it's not like there. Well, I was going to say it's not like there are spelling errors, but I take that back. There is a spelling error here. I did copy and paste these questions, so there are spelling errors. But you know, when you ask us questions, please spell things correctly. I got to put up with enough with James and his wacky, words that don't mean anything, and I don't believe half of these words exist. So when you give me real words that I would know that are spelled wrong, it just adds to my confusion, and I don't appreciate it.
Oh, I've got all sorts of made-up words. You're going to love these.
Oh, I believe it. Mm-hmm. I believe it. So here's the first one.
Let's just jump into it.
Let's jump in.
Sock it to me.
Okay. Can you discuss selenine and farnesene a little more? And I'm going to insert my own editorial here. I'm not sure we ever discussed them in the first place, so I don't know why a little more. But they seem to be good markers for UK and SAS genetics, respectively. But selenine gets ignored on oil data sheets, even when a significant proportion of it is present. It's mm-hmm. high in celery seeds, and some UK hops can be pretty vegetal, and could that be related there? So go. I'm going to drink from my growler.
Okay. Good question. That's a good question. And selenine is oftentimes not even reported. I would say not often. The majority of the time, not even reported. Although it can be present in considerable quantities, so single-digit percentages of the oil complex, selenine can be there. People are like, selenine, what the hell? It's a sesquiterpene, much like caryophyllene and humulene. And as such, it's a pretty big molecule. It's two carbon ring structures smashed together. So it's very stable. It's very heat stable. It takes a lot of energy to volatilize, and it has a very high sensory threshold. So it takes a lot of it for humans to even notice it's there. As opposed to farnesene, which is what we call a monoterpene. So instead of being a ring structure, it's a kind of a long chain. And by virtue of it being a long chain, it's pretty sensitive to volatilizing, very sensitive to damage and oxidation. And it has a much, much, much lower sensory threshold than selenine does. So two terpenes, one's sesquiterpene or a ring structure, one is a monoterpene or a chain. So that's not, they're not the same thing.
Well, of course not. I never would suggest right. They were.
Well, duh. Who would have thought? Heresy. Anyway, so just because they're terpenes doesn't necessarily mean that they have like attributes. Let's put it that way. For selenine, it's just it's there's not much to it. And people say, well, it because it comes from celery, it must be very vegetal. No, one doesn't mean the other. So it was first, I believe, isolated from celery and celeriac. It isn't the culprit or the cause of celery flavor. But if you look at some of the other plants that selenine is considerable, besides celery, is like Asian ginseng. So Chinese ginseng, it's in there. It's in the root. Something called, you ever heard of chervil? Sweet chervil? Yeah, oftentimes called garden myrrh. Everybody's got a little garden myrrh around, right? How about Piper nigrum? Black pepper.
I saw her in a movie once.
Did you?
Piper nigrum, yeah.
Yeah, you don't want to. That's not a family-friendly movie.
No.
No. Mm-mm. I wonder where she's dancing now. Anyway, and then you have it's various species and subspecies of eucalyptus. It's pretty prominent in, as well as some very exotic citrus fruit from the Philippines. But although it is kind of herbal, and it is not responsible for the vegetal characteristic, that's comes from other parts of the vegetation, not necessarily the essential oils, although it is related to humulene and caryophyllene, which have a very herbal fragrance oftentimes associated with marijuana. The makeup of those oils in those hops, the European English style hops, is one of genetics, and genetics is determining the production of those compounds. It's a little bit from the environment and the horticulture side, but mostly the genetics side. It's something that you're going to find in those varieties more often than other varieties, but it doesn't, I believe, doesn't necessarily impact the flavor characteristics to make those things it doesn't bring them all that much notoriety, let's put it that way.
Okay.
It's kind of boring. It's not that big of a wow factor. Selenine isn't. Farnesene is.
Mm-hmm. And farnesene I've actually heard of before in our conversation. Mm-hmm. I'm sure I've heard of it from you.
Yep.
Okay. All right. So that was our first question. What is our next one here? I've got my list. What is the best height for burn back in terms of airflow, and what chemical is best to use?
What height is best? I don't know. I've always wanted like 3 feet, a meter, right? So something between ground level and a meter. How's that sound? Not to be facetious, it's just about removing all that less than healthy foliage so that you can get good airflow through the crown to reduce disease pressure and to make like a basically a little fire break between soil borne downy mildew spores and leaves to prevent, you know, the disease from creeping up the plant.
So it's not so much a height, a strict height restriction, as it is how does the plant look and where does it look like you're starting to get the healthier plant starting.
Right, and frankly, if you're going down through there and you're spraying, you know, vertically, you've got like a spray nozzle on the side of your tractor, and you're far enough away from the plant that the spread is like 2 to 3 feet wide. So that's ends up being your band. I mean, there's no real science behind it. For some smaller growers and hobby growers that want to try this, they'll be like, oh man, but I've got cones down that far. Yeah, I'm going to guess that they're not very mature. And because they're down low, they're heavily shaded, they're probably the last sidearms to flower, so they're not even going to be mature by the time you harvest. It's just casualties of war. Spray them out, get rid of them. It's far better to have that fire break from downy and other soil-borne diseases than it is for the, you know, half a bushel of hops you're going to lose on a couple of acres.
Sure.
But for chemicals, what's the best chemical?
The best.
The best, the absolute best that I've ever found is a chemical called paraquat. even, and so it's a burned down herbicide. It is toxic as hell.
Yeah, that's not hops approved, is it?
It is definitely not hops approved. And something I was talking to one of the hopnologists about earlier in the week, and this question might have come from them, was, you know, well, what is the best chemical? I'm like, well, Gramoxone, which is Paraquat, works fantastic, but it's not labeled for hops. But the pallets of Paraquat that I've seen on large farms in the Pacific Northwest, I don't know what they're calling it or how they're hiding using it or if they got an exemption to use it, but holy crap, Paraquat works great. But to you, like you said, I don't think it's legal to use in hops, and it's not labeled for hop use, certainly outside of emergency use in the Pacific Northwest. So barring that, because it works like freaking magic, barring that, what do you use? I've used pretty much everything that is labeled for hops. I've tried it anyway, and I've never been happy with it. It's just, and certainly for the cost of it, it's pretty ridiculous. I'll use kind of trade names, like AIM is one of them. Scythe is another one. And there's a few others in there. But when I needed to burn down and I was going to spray, quote, on label, it would be just 28% urea ammonium nitrate fertilizer. That's it. Not cut with anything, straight. And that's a lot of salt. And so I'm going on at a very, very, very low rate. And at the time of the year that I'm applying this, you're like, oh, you can't add that much nitrogen to your plants. You're going to screw up flowering. You're going to screw up alpha. I'm adding so little nitrogen as to not really affect my tissue analysis much at all. I've never noticed an actual highly correlated bump in sap nitrogen after one of those sprays.
Okay.
So I'm not worried about it. Plus you're spraying out these old tattered leaves anyway that aren't all that photosynthetic, and they're not really all that active in terms of, like, the vascular structure is already kind of breaking down in it, so it's not going to transport into the plant very easily. So I would just use straight up 28% UAN. And that worked just as good as, for me anyway, in my scenario, as some of this other more expensive things, and it is wicked cheap.
Well, yeah, there's that. I mean, if it's easy to come by and it does the same job as the more expensive name brands, then.
Right. For me, it did.
Yeah.
And so that's what I did. And I'm cheap as hell, as Dan is very fond of saying.
All right.
What else you got?
What else do I got? Well, Tim wanted us to solve the Collett's conjecture, which
just after I'm almost done with proving Fermat's theorem, less than two sheets of paper. So as soon as I get done with that.
Okay, I'm working on this one. I'm working
on
the four color map problem myself, which is
I'm a fan
of that one. But
yeah,
okay. So barring the higher level mathematics, let's go back to some words that aren't in English, or any other language that I can think
Latin?
Of. I don't know. Well, look, you just spent a few minutes talking about Paraquat, which the last time I saw, I thought he was the bad king in Shrek. So.
Oh, boy, he just Mr. One-liner tonight.
I call him as I see him. Mm-hmm. Hey, my growler's empty already. Look at that. Okay. No, joke. Next question here. Can you discuss the relationship between...
Oh, God. It's when they start like that. You know it's going
to
be good.
Well, yeah, I took a pause there. I'm trying to think.
Compare and contrast. Mm-hmm. Like, what am I, back in 10th grade... literature?
Well, it's actually the relationship between a couple of celebrities that they want to get a little info. No. The relationship between polyphenol content, field practices, and genotype. I love when this happens. I think I read somewhere. Here you go. I think I read somewhere that continental growers rely less on irrigation than the U.S. growers due to higher average rainfall and that inconsistent watering. Oh, and they read somewhere else that inconsistent watering increased polyphenol production as a stress response. So they're wondering if that different character in different areas could have something to do with field practices more so than genotype.
Another good question. So let's throw some definitions in here first. So genotype, basically the genetic characteristics of a given group of like plants. So in this case, a genotype would be European hop varieties, as opposed to like American or New Zealand, that are kind of grouped together as a genetic family because they're all kind of bred from the same stock. So that's what this person means when they say genotype. So this sort of wide range of varieties that aren't directly related to one another from a direct breeding standpoint, but are bred from a stock from a general region, let's call it. So given that, can horticultural practices, in this case watering or irrigation or lack thereof, something we call deficit irrigation, can deficit irrigation as a horticultural practice impact, let's say, flavor and aroma of a horticultural crop? Abso-frickin-lutely. And we do it all the time, and we've been doing it for thousands of years. So it's nothing new. In stone fruit production, cherries, true, but peaches and apricots and nectar and stuff like that, even grapes, we deficit irrigate. So basically send the plant into a bit of water stress in order to do things like improve color, improve sugar content, flavor, aroma. So can the same practice happen in hops? It would stand to reason, yes. In this particular case, we're talking about polyphenols as a stress compound. Polyphenols are in a group of, well, polyphenols, they are a group of chemicals. Lots of tannins are polyphenol that are responsible for really tasting, causing the astringent, dry mouthfeel of like a red wine. Same thing with beer, dry hop beer. When they're over dry hopped, you get a lot of this really, what they call harsh bitter on the sides of your tongue.
Mm-hmm, sure.
That everybody used to say was cohumulin, but we know that's a bunch of bullshit. It's these polyphenols, and polyphenols are water soluble. Some hops are naturally higher in these polyphenols than other varieties. So basically dry hopping with the wrong one at too high of a concentration can leave you with something that's disgusting. In this case, polyphenols are known to increase in plants that are undergoing drought and heat stress. But I think that's a far cry from that to saying that because growers in Europe don't have irrigation, their plants are therefore drought stressed and therefore have higher polyphenols and therefore result in this character of continental hops. I think that is an absolutely incorrect statement to make. Mm-hmm. And an assumption too far to make, because they, for years and years and years and years, the reason they don't have irrigation is because they've never needed it, because they could get an inch of rain a week all through the production season. So why the hell irrigate? You don't need to. It's only recently that they've started to experience these drought conditions, but the attributes of those genotypes have not appreciably changed over the last 15 years. So in the face of those data, that assumption, the hypothesis of increased polyphenols due to deficit irrigation causes or is a factor in continental hop flavor, I would say that hypothesis is not correct, because mm-hmm. the data doesn't support it. So, yes, polyphenols can increase due to drought stress or deficit irrigation. In general, is that occurring causing the characteristic of those continental genotypes? No, I don't believe so.
Makes sense. It does make sense. The whole
yes,
yes and no. Mm-hmm. the whole concept of the stressing I find fascinating, because you really are, you know, we trust Mother Nature. She puts all this stuff together. The systems work as intended when we obey the rules. And mm-hmm. when we stress things, we mess with the rules, but we mess with the rules in a way that can be beneficial, at least for us, yep. If we want a sweeter apple.
Yep, exactly. And we do that in apples all the time, too. We stress them, and even we will chemically stress them. Mm-hmm. We will chemically, so processing tomatoes, we chemically stress them to make them change color at the time when they're supposed to be harvested, even though they may not be physically ripe yet. We stress them just to make them change color. That's why they end up tasting like wood, but they look good. Because you bypass all the good aroma-producing stuff only to force them to change color.
Something wrong with us.
Mm-hmm.
Just something wrong.
Yeah.
All right, next one.
Oh, geez.
Ready for this? A list of recommended temperatures for things like cold storage, pellets as soon as they come out of the mill, pellets when they enter the bags.
Processing question.
Processing question. About temperature.
Sure. Let's look at what we can do there. So let's start at the mill. I'm a big proponent, as everyone knows, of low temperature drying in hops because heat drives off aromatic compounds. And so keep the hops cool, keep more of the aroma in the hop. Let's take that to the pellet mill, where you're compressing under high force all of this mill powder, and you're squishing it through the die, and you're creating a lot of friction, which creates a lot of heat. So then you say, okay, well, I want to keep these things really cool. I can't have any heat building up. Well, sorta. As the pellet passes through the die, it is going to warm up, and actually we need it to warm up because there's what we call hard waxes and hard resins in the hop as part of the lupulin complex. They're hard at room temperature, but as you heat them up, they become more gummy, and that's actually kind of the glue that's sticking your pellet together. So if you're actually trying to pelletize too cold, you're going to get really poor binding of the material. If you pelletize too hot, it's going to scorch all those resins. They're going to come out brown and shiny, which you don't want either. So you got to be somewhere in happy middle. So it's okay to expose those pellets to heat, 130, 140 degrees, whatever it happens to be, as it's passing through the die, in order to activate those resins to get some binding to happen. But then you want to drop that temperature as soon as you possibly can. And you don't want that exposure in the die to that temperature to be very long at all. Otherwise it will scorch, and it will scorch like in under 10 seconds. So you want those pellets flying out of that mill, even if they are a little warm. But then that pellet's going to cool down. And if you don't let the pellet cool down, well, how cold does it need to get? Room temperature. If you don't let it cool down from compression temp to room temp, when you pick it up and try and handle it, it's going to fall apart. And so oftentimes I see growers bag their hops far too early, right out of the mill. They haven't cooled down. And actually you can feel the bag, and the bag's like warm. You're handling those hops, those pellets in the bag, and as you're moving the bag around, they're still breaking down. And so by the time the brewer goes to use it and open it up, you got a bunch of powder in there.
That's no good.
Which is definitely no good. So you want this time period for hops to cool down or temper. Let's call it anneal. That's a great word, anneal. You want this thing to anneal so that those hard waxes become hard again and form a firmer pellet, so it resists breaking in handling. We had a shaker conveyor on our system. It was about 10 or 15 feet long. It was two or three sections that shook horizontally, and the hops would scoot along this perforated screen, so it would shake any dust off that was left behind. And we had ours closed with like acrylic on the top, and we were pumping in nitrogen gas from the liquid nitrogen tanks as a coolant, as well as a nitrogen blanket to keep oxygen away. Not necessary for everybody, but that was part of our shtick with AromaSmart. Ultimately, we were getting those pellets cooled down. You know, they would come out of the mill at 120 degrees, and they would be cooled down to room temperature or below, sometimes into the mid to high 50 degree Fahrenheit range, in a matter of about 10 seconds. Then they were annealed. They were not going to fall apart when you handled them. And then you could put them in conveyors and raise them up, and they would flow. We had a gravity dispenser for filling bags that you could put the pellets in there once they were annealed, and you had this little weight switch. It would open up, it auto-fill the bag, and it wouldn't get stuck. If you didn't let those pellets anneal, they would get stuck. They would be too sticky. They would fall apart. They would bridge. It's just things were not good. So annealing is also good for handling.
Yep.
Room temperature or below.
And the other thing to point out about the conveyor belt there is that if you've got your pellets coming out and they're hot and going into buckets, anything in the middle of that bucket is going to stay warm. It's not going to cool down. So you've got to spread them out in some capacity Otherwise, you know, everything around the edges, it's getting lots of oxygen. Yay. We know that's not good for it. But anything in the middle is just sitting there in a nice little hot blanket, and it's continuing to be to stay warm, and it won't cool down nearly as quickly.
Correct. And you've got those pellets are exposed to oxygen in the middle too. So oxygen plus heat equals increased rate of oxidation. So it's actually better to get them spread out, get them cooled down quickly, then get them into bags.
Plus a conveyor belt that vibrates and bumps up and down. It's fun for going on rides when you're bored in the middle of the pellet process. Yep.
As long as you don't want to have any children, you're in good shape. Oh, yeah. So for you, you're done with that. Just knock yourself out. I mean, it's okay. But
enough's enough.
Yeah, you don't. Yeah, it's not good on the lower back either. it's very painful. That's getting the pellets down to, you know, temperature to get them in the bag. But then how about freezing or cooling? Well, it's never a good idea on any whatever refrigeration system you have to put a massive heat load on it all at once. So allowing those pellets to lose heat to cool down is going to also prolong the life of whatever refrigeration equipment you've got. Some folks don't have walk-in freezers, right? They've got maybe a chest freezer. Those little chest freezers are not made. I mean, think about it like this. Make it a bunch of steaming hot soup in 5-gallon buckets and stick it in your freezer. It ain't going to be happy. Mm. It's going to take a long time to draw that heat out and get it down to temperature where you'd be much better served for the freezer and for your hops to draw the heat out at down to room temperature and then put it in when it's more stable and allow that heat to be drawn out over, you know, a more reasonable period of time by that refrigerator or freezer. And things are going to be happier longer.
Makes sense. Makes absolute sense.
The other thing I've seen, too, is when people put they'll take pellets that are too hot, too warm, they haven't annealed, they put them in a bag, they draw a hard vacuum on them. Everything looks great. Right. And you come back an hour later, you're like, hey, that vacuum's still hard. Everything looks great. You feel it. It's still warm. They put it in the freezer. And over time, as those pellets finally cool down and change temperature, for whatever reason, you lose the vacuum. I don't know. I still don't know why. Huh. But it almost every time that we would notice that that's a hard vac. Those are hot pellets. A week, a month later, you open up that box that the bag's in and the vacuum's gone. Hmm. And I don't know why.
Yeah, you got me. If you're waiting for an answer, I'm not going to provide it.
Cool the pellets down first, then put them in the bag. Then you're okay.
Yeah, makes sense. But room temperature. And then you go to your refrigeration or your freezing from to your point, a much lower point, and you're preventing your system there from having to be overtaxed. So speaking of pelletization,
yep.
Next question here. And again, I love the way this is worded. I've heard.
Oh, God.
I've heard of some of the newer Neo-Mexicanus varieties like Sabro that they pelletize very differently than most hops with an oilier texture. I'm wondering if that physical difference could indicate fatty alcohol or wax production as an insulation response to the higher heat and stronger sunlight of where they're grown in the lower latitudes?
No. Next question.
All right. Next question.
Want me to unpack that a little bit?
Sure. Sure. There's a lot going on there.
There's a lot going on there. And this is what I would say. You know that old saying, a little knowledge is dangerous? Mm-hmm. And I think this is that case where we're making too many assumptions and too many correlations where there really aren't any because of a little bit of knowledge we might have about something. So this is not straightforward. So let's unpack these two things. Number one, is Neo-Mexicanus somehow or another more oily or waxy or something like that compared to any other hop? No, not appreciably. Is Neo-Mexicanus going to pelletize differently because of its genotype, like we talked about earlier? Nope, not at all. Because within the same genotype families, let's say Brewer's Gold, super oily, high levels of overall oil content. We know that total oil content and has a influence on the pelletizing process, how easily those hops shred in the hammer mill and how well they are easily they compress in the pellet mill. And so you have to change up your your pelletizing settings a little bit based on those oily hops versus, you know, something that's less oily like a Hallertau or Mount Hood or something like that. So we know that that's true. However, this is what I heard when you read that to me. Neomexicanus grows in places with high heat and puts up with a lot of stress. It's also said to be oily and more oily or waxy than any others. Therefore, it's producing these compounds in order to protect itself from the high heat. And no, those assumptions and those correlations are unsubstantiated, because we could say the same thing about hops that grow in the Yakima Valley, which is equally as hot as something like the high desert plateaus in New Mexico, even hotter in some cases. And we don't see that that's happening. Hmm. Now, let's talk about the comment about fatty acids and things like that.
Yep.
So why would we think that this is the case? So again, a little knowledge can be dangerous. Well, it has everything to do with something called membrane fluidity, cell membrane fluidity. And around the cell, there's this layer, this membrane of fat. It's called lipids, and there's actually a double layer. It's called the bilipid membrane. Fats, lipids, have different levels of fluidity based on their temperature. So think about like vegetable shortening, Crisco. It's solid at room temperature, but you stick it in the frying pan and heat it up, it becomes liquid. So all oils, all fats exhibit this. So on the cold side of things, if your cell membrane gets too cold, the membrane gets so stiff it can fracture and juices can leak out. That's why we see, like, if you put lettuce or basil or things like that in the crisper and it gets too cold and it starts to go all wilty nasty on you, right? That's called ion leakage or water soaking. And what's happened is that those lipids in the membrane have become so cold or too cold, they've started to fracture open and all the goo is leaking out. Not good if you're a plant.
No, not at all.
Right. Same thing happens on the hot side. If the membrane gets too hot, it gets super fluid and can, well, get a little too thin, a little too stretched out. And the pressure from inside the cell, turgor pressure, can actually rupture the cell because the membrane's a little bit too fluid. That's our oversimplified, but that's what can happen. So the plant can't pick up and move. It's got to deal with these things. The way it does that is by modifying that lipid membrane with other compounds. Think about antifreeze. That's what we're talking about. If you don't want your radiator to freeze in cold temperatures, you add something to lower the freezing point of that water in your radiator. Same thing happens with these alcohol fatty acids, is they would actually keep the more likely to keep the membrane more fluid at low temperatures, not high. At high temperatures, you need something kind of to hold things together, like a buttress. And then that's where you get into something called heat shock proteins, where you can actually, the plant will produce proteins to help shield the membrane in order to sort of hold it together like belt and suspenders. So that's the dirty details around membrane fluidity and how the plant responds to it. Even if it were the case and alcohol fatty acids were involved on the hot side, they would be so small compared to the fat that's in the membrane already, you'd see nothing in its physical form. No, it would do nothing.
Yeah, no physical manifestation
there. Right. See how much easier it was for me to just say no?
It was.
So when I'm talking and about this kind of stuff, and I'm like, you ask me a question, I'll pause, and that's me thinking, should I just give them the straight answer? Because some people don't be like, oh, what do you mean? Explain it. And then when I explain it, they're like, oh, are you talking over our heads? Shut up, Kevin. That's how it is. So I have to walk a fine line here.
Mm-hmm.
It's no, but, or no, because. And most time people just tune out like you do when I start talking about the because.
What? Well, and I think you said it just the other day on the Discord server. You said, I can't speak Russian or play the ukulele. Because yep. Someone said, well, you know, geez, is there anything you don't know? Well, yeah. but this you happen to know.
Because chemistry, bitches. That's why.
Okay, that's the next t-shirt.
Okay, yeah.
That's the next t-shirt. Hold on. Before I read the next one, I got to write this down.
All right,
because chemistry, bitches. That two or three exclamation points on that one. I think three.
Three.
All right, next question.
Yep.
What is the average airspeed velocity of a laden swallow?
African or European?
That is the correct response.
Duh. God, give me a hard one.
I just needed to get a breather in there. Okay.
Next question. You're going to ask me what my favorite color is, right?
Nah, that's too easy. Because because you know yours is not going to be one of the Roy G. Biv variety. It's going to be some bizarre color that's only found in some strange rainforest somewhere.
Not in the visible spectrum. That ultraviolet.
That was my always was my favorite thing when the kids were younger and they'd get some kind of piece of candy and I'd look at it and say, that's not a color found in nature.
Yes.
So the next question, it's not even a question. It's not even in the form of a question. It's just two words.
Nice.
I have to get a running start to pronounce this. Carotenoid degradation.
Oh, you mangled that. Carotenoid.
Carotenoid. Okay.
Carotenoid. You got a running start and then you tripped over your own feet. Man. Yeah. Carotenoid degradation. What about it?
That's the whole thing.
That's it.
That's all I got. That's all I've got. I've got number 8, carotenoid degradation.
If I were a betting man, I would bet that this has something to do with somebody probably read something somewhere that terpenes, so we talked about those at the top of the episode when we were talking about selenine, we were talking about all those sesquiterpenes. Terpenes that form in hops are part of the carotenoid biosynthesis pathway. And carotenoids are a gigantic family of phytochemicals that do loads of stuff. They're antioxidants, they're pigments, they're flavonoids, they're all kinds of stuff. There's all kinds of carotenoids. It's just not one. It's like, there's a carotenoid. It's right there. That's it. No. There's bajillions of them. Part of the biosynthesis for these sesquiterpenes and terpenes is they're like the end result or a branch off of one of the various pathways of the carotenoid biosynthesis. So I'm guessing somebody's going to say, can you determine ripeness or harvest timing or aroma content by tracking what you said called the degradation?
Yes.
Degradation of the carotenoids levels.
So let's define degradation.
Let's talk about degradation. It's not like these carotenoids are just dissolving into nothing and like, you know, Thanos in the snap, right? They're just not turning to dust and vanishing. They're changing, right? That's the biosynthesis part. Something is happening to that compound to change it into something else. So it's not like it's degrading. It's not like it's oxidizing and dissolving. Well, it could be oxidizing, but it's not like it's breaking down and rotting when we think of degradation. So I think what would probably be the better term is to say, can you look at carotenoid level changes, right? Can you track and correlate a decrease in the level of these carotenoids and an increase in these terpenes and sesquiterpenes? Could you do that? Yes, you could do that. Does it make sense to do that as a measure of hop ripeness and tracking harvest? No. Because just freaking measure the terpenes. Why do you need to measure the carotenoid breakdown products when they could be breaking down into other things that are not sesquiterpenes and terpenes? Because there's a bajillion other pathways. So it's like saying, okay, I'm gonna count all the cars on this interstate by just counting the ones that come off of this exit down here and not even look at any of the other cars that come off the exits, 20 exits in front of me. It doesn't make any sense. So if you wanted to gauge harvest, you would just measure the terpenes and sesquiterpenes at the end, and that's it. That's how you would do that.
That makes sense. Make it easier on yourself. All right, we got one more here. I think we have time for one more.
Sure.
And it's, is there a difference in what you need to do from a weed prevention standpoint in year one versus later years?
Yes. Next question. You want a yes, but?
Well, yeah, a yes and elaborate.
Okay, yes and elaborate. So why would we care about weeds in year one versus year two and year three? And I think we have to level set on what a weed actually is. And so instead of saying weeds, let's think about competition. The competition between your hop plant for nutrients, water, sunlight. So anybody else around you, they're competitors. You could win, Greg, even you could win the gold medal in swimming if there were no other competitors, right?
Even I could. Well, yes.
Even yes. You could. So that's what, and what's that one? What's that little ribbon dancing gymnastics thing? You'd absolutely kill if you weren't competing against anybody for that one. So.
I don't even know where to go with that.
So I want to see. That'll be one of the Instagram pictures.
Of me ribbon dancing? I don't
ribbon dancing, so. Yeah. No. Yeah. So, yeah. Totally derailed myself.
Yeah.
Well, the idea there is competition. And in year one, when you're trying to get those plants established, you want to give them absolutely the best shot at a strong establishment, because the faster and stronger they establish in year one, the quicker they're going to get to a mature yield. And one of the ways that we can get, and we, you know, growers have got some experience under their belt, we can get to a mature yield in year two is by ensuring zero or to close to zero competition in year one. So that's the first thing. That, you know, and it's not just, you know, these other plants, weeds or otherwise, competing for nutrients, for sunlight, for water, for airflow, all kinds of stuff. Get them out of there. Get rid of them. That brings up a good question about other plants in the hop yard, like companion plants and biodiversity, which I think is a different topic, and when to introduce those, because I think there is a benefit to having other plants in the hop yard as opposed to like a moonscaped monoculture sort of scenario. But certainly in year one, you want to minimize that or completely eliminate it as much as possible. Year two and three, as that plant gets bigger and bigger and those roots spread out and there's more rhizomes and the plant's just overall more vigorous, it's going to be able to more aggressively compete against some of these other plants that might creep into the hop yard, mm-hmm. such that it's not going to rob the plant as much from a nutrient standpoint as it might when those plants were just trying to get established. Yes, it is important, more important, I think, to have a weed-free or non-competition scenario in year one compared to two and three and on. There's other reasons why you want to get rid of those other, you know, the weed plants in later years besides just competition. But that's my take on that.
Makes sense. Makes perfect sense. This, you know, anything about establishment, about initial establishment, it mm-hmm. is certainly a little bit different. Probably something we want to get into in more detail at another time.
Another time. Mm-hmm.
That is everything from the mailbag. So please keep the questions coming. This is
mailbag.
Yep. This is, yeah, that's not a good sound effect. We'll
mailbag.
We'll get a better one than that. like dead silence. So really, this is fun for us to go through a whole bunch of shorter questions, you know, as opposed to one broad form topic, and get mm-hmm. those questions into us. We tend to answer them a lot on the Discord or via emails, but it's fun to save these up and hit them all like this.
Well, certainly if it's impactful for other people.
Yes. Yeah. Well, if it's individualized questions like, hey, how does this tie look on me? We're not going to take that to the mailbag. Something wrong with us.